The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from the issue of The Week, dated December 14th. 2012. As usual, we'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. Our first article here is entitled Obama GOP Trade Offers on the Fiscal Cliff. Here's what happened. President Obama and House Republicans each issued proposals to avert the fiscal cliff this past week that the other side instantly dismissed, leaving both parties locked in stalemate over the combination of tax increases and spending cuts due to kick in January 1st. Obama's proposal calls for $1.6 trillion in new tax revenue over the next decade, principally by letting the Bush tax cuts expire for the 2% of Americans earning over $250,000 a year, with $400 billion in entitlement reform. House Speaker John Boehner called the proposal unserious and laid out a $2.2 trillion counterproposal to cut entitlement spending by $900 billion, cut discretionary spending by $300 billion, and raise $800 billion in new revenue with unspecified new limits on tax deductions. Obama said the GOP's offer was still out of balance because it did not raise enough new revenue. "We're not going to be able to get a deal without it," he said. Boehner's proposal was already rejected by the Tea Party faction in his own party, with Senator Jim DeMint, the Republican from South Carolina, saying that any tax hike will destroy jobs. If the talks collapse, House Republicans were reportedly considering a doomsday plan of letting the Democrats extend the Bush tax cuts for the middle class before January 1st. Republicans would then launch a bigger fight to cut federal spending and reform the tax code in the new year, with a key piece of leverage, the $16.4 trillion debt ceiling, which must be raised in February to avert a government shutdown. Now, here's what the editorial said. "Mr. President, you've taken your victory lap," said the Chicago Tribune. "Now it's time to get serious. Republicans won't support essentially the same tax-centric budget they rejected last year, with no serious attempt to cut spending or reform entitlements. It's the Republicans who've made an absurd offer," said the New York Times. "If they had done any actual math, they'd know it's impossible to raise $800 billion through eliminating mortgage interest and charitable deductions without seriously damaging the nonprofit sector or raising taxes on the middle class. Face it, it's not possible to make a serious dent in the federal deficit without an end to the Bush tax cuts on the rich." Now here's what the columnist said. "How John Boehner must want to go back in time," said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. "In 2011, the president offered House Republicans a deal with a 3-to-1 ratio of spending cuts to new revenue. They walked away, betting Obama would be defeated. The bet failed. Now a split-the-difference compromise is all they can hope for. $1.2 trillion in new revenues and $750 billion in spending cuts wouldn't be such a surprise. The only question is how to get those revenues." Given that Obama successfully campaigned on higher taxes for the wealthy, they may be unavoidable, said Fred Barnes in WeeklyStandard.com. But the GOP can limit the damage by negotiating to ensure that taxes remain lower than the top Clinton-era rate of 39.6%. and insisting that increases apply only to those earning $1 million, not $250,000. In return, Republicans should demand substantive entitlement reforms, said Scott Galluppo in the AmericanConservative.com. If the GOP is going to violate its blood contract on tax increases, Obama must accept the need for serious spending cuts. A package of $1 trillion in cuts over 10 years is a realistic target to shoot for. That assumes Boehner is able to bargain, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, but his hands are tied by his conservative caucus, which is as crazed and intransigent as ever. That's why Obama's most strategic move here is to hold fast to his demands and let January 1st pass. At that point, the top tax rate automatically reverts to 39.6%. Obama can then offer Republicans a small rate cut to, say, 38%, making up the lost revenue by closing loopholes and capping deductions. Toss in some more spending cuts to sweeten the deal, restore some Pentagon funding, and voila. That's a deal Republicans will be able to sell to their base, but it's only possible after January 1st. The next item from the main story section, Obama's red line on Syria. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's grip on his war-torn nation was slipping this past week as President Obama warned the increasingly desperate regime that it would be held accountable if it deployed chemical weapons against its own people. Obama issued that warning after intelligence agencies reported that the regime was preparing its arsenal of nerve agents for use amid signs that the 20-month-old war could be turning against it. Street battles raged in Damascus's suburbs, and rebels closed the highway to the capital's international airport. Opposition fighters also overran a military base near Aleppo, acquiring a stash of surface-to-air missiles that could neutralize the government's air power advantage. An influential Russian political analyst said Assad had told Russian emissaries he had lost all hope of retaining power, so was now fighting for his physical survival. Assad faces an impossible dilemma, said David Blair in telegraph.co.uk. From his point of view, the only rational reason for using these weapons would be if his downfall seemed inevitable, which it is. But that would trigger a U.S.-led intervention sealing his fate. So rationality dictates that he should not use these weapons under any circumstances, but this bloodthirsty tyrant, shielded from reality by his criminal entourage, may no longer be capable of rational thinking. Assad isn't the only player we have to worry about, said Bennett Ramberg in Reuters.com. If his regime collapses, al-Qaeda or Hezbollah terrorists might rush in and grab chemical weapons. Washington could ask rebels to safeguard any chemical depots they overrun, but it's unclear whether Islamists in the opposition can be trusted. U.S. special forces, backed up by air power, could be sent in to eliminate this deadly stockpile. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, said The Guardian in the UK in an editorial. This war isn't over yet. The rebels, who mostly hail from Syria's Sunni majority, aren't strong enough to take Damascus, but nor are they in any mood to withdraw. And the 80,000 troops defending the city, many of them members of the Alawite minority, won't surrender out of fear they'll lose their property and lives if the regime falls. Even if Assad himself does not survive, Syria still faces a final showdown of a profoundly sectarian nature. And the next article, the Israel-Palestine rift deepens. One day after the UN General Assembly voted last week to elevate Palestine to observer state status, Israel advanced plans to build 3,000 new homes on contested land in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. These activities set back the cause of a negotiated peace, said Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, calling on Israel to shelve its plans. Israel's announcement was seen as retaliation for the UN's overwhelming endorsement of Palestine. The U.S. was one of only 9 countries to stand with Israel, and Clinton said the administration would continue to have Israel's back. That uncritical stance confirms America's irrelevance to resolving the Israel-Palestine conflict, said Henry Siegman in foreignpolicy.com. It dooms President Obama's efforts to renew peace talks as an empty and purposeless exercise. Unless the U.S. demands that Israel accept its pre-1967 borders as a starting point, negotiations have no prospect of producing anything other than cover for Israel's continuing predatory colonial behavior. Obama has to stop the settlements, not just to save face, but to protect Americans, said Robert Wright in TheAtlantic.com. The UN vote did not increase the risk of terrorism by much, but the announcement of an epically indefensible settlement project did. Whenever the Arab world perceives further insults to the Palestinians, the U.S. is naturally seen as complicit. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has to hear that if he doesn't reverse course, Obama will publicly announce that America can no longer guarantee that it will stand by Israel's side. The White House already has a more nefarious way to undermine Israel, said Elliot Abrams in NationalReview.com. It engages in polite diplomatic criticism, then privately urges the Europeans to lower the boom. It was probably at U.S. behest that several European countries just dressed down Israeli ambassadors. Obama clearly wants to hurt Netanyahu's chances in upcoming elections by suggesting that he can't get along with Europe or the United States. Upset that Netanyahu backed Mitt Romney, Obama now wishes to return the favor. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week in the main point section. The fiscal cliff. What happens if there is no deal? Relax, said Edward Crutey in Reuters.com. Falling off a fiscal cliff sounds like it would bring horrible and possibly fatal consequences. But fears that the nation will suddenly tumble into recession on January 1st are overblown, even if Congress and the White House can't make a deal to forestall the massive tax increases and spending cuts due to take effect that day. Contrary to what some doomsayers have predicted, income taxes won't go up overnight and $500 billion won't suddenly be sucked out of the economy. If there's no deal and the Bush tax cuts expire for all Americans, President Obama can order the Treasury to delay collecting any higher taxes for at least a few months. The Pentagon and other federal agencies facing automatic 10% budget cuts can simply front-load their spending and hope Obama and Congress strike a deal to restore some funding later. There would be some immediate effects of jumping off the cliff, said Michael Shear in the New York Times. The first paychecks of 2013 would shrink slightly with the expiration of last year's 2% payroll tax cut, but much of the impact would not be felt for months, giving Washington a bit more time to come to its senses. You're forgetting the psychological impact, said the Baltimore Sun in an editorial. Even a brief fall over the cliff could roil financial markets, sap business and consumer confidence, and send the economy back into recession. Ominously, there are signs that both sides are no longer terrified by that prospect. President Obama may be encouraged to jump the cliff by new polls showing that, by a 2-to-1 margin, the public would blame congressional Republicans for any economic damage. House Speaker John Boehner, meanwhile, now faces a Tea Party rebellion if he acquiesces to Obama's demand for higher tax rates on the top 2% of wage earners. Watch out, folks. This could get bumpy. The good news is that the fiscal cliff is really a fiscal slope, said Joseph Lazzaro in the International Business Times. But the bad news is that if there's still no deal by February or March, the stock and world markets will conclude that Washington is hopelessly gridlocked and cannot address the nation's mounting debt problem. That would lead to another downgrade of the U.S. credit rating, a loss of investor confidence, and serious long-term economic damage. To prove that the U.S. is sane and solvent, we need more than a limited deal on the top tax rate, said Clive Crook in Bloomberg.com. We need a grand bargain to reform and simplify the tax code, rein in entitlement spending, and put the country's fiscal house in order. Anything less would not dispel the confusion or get the economy growing. Major U.S. companies are already scaling back their investments at the fastest pace in 3 years out of trepidation about what may lie ahead. Maybe a little panic in the financial markets is just what the doctor ordered, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. Let's face it, neither Republicans nor Democrats will compromise on deeply felt fiscal principles until they have no other choice. That means no grand bargain addressing the larger spending and tax issues until the markets start freaking out and Americans are furious at both sides. When have we ever seen Congress make a deal before its back was up against the wall? Now, from the Week magazine, we turn to the column Good Week For and Bad Week For. It was a good week for infallible tweets after Pope Benedict XVI unveiled his personal Twitter account at Pontifex, which instantly gained more than 475,000 followers. They're still awaiting his first tweet. Making and not taking, after Mitt Romney found a job rejoining the Marriott Hotel chain's board of directors. Directors of the Mormon-run company are paid $60,000 and given $110,000 in Marriott stock, plus $1,250 for every meeting they attend. And it was a good week for taking after Detroit City Councilwoman Joanne Watson said that President Obama should use federal funds to bail out the struggling city, which is facing bankruptcy. Our people, in an overwhelming way, supported the reelection of this president, Watson said, and there ought to be a quid pro quo. It was a bad week for waiting to use the toilet after a new survey found that one out of three people between 18 and 24 use their smartphones in the bathroom to check Facebook and other social media. It was a bad week for inflexibility after a worker at a New Orleans convenience store clamped a metal boot on the tire of an ambulance parked outside. The paramedics were inside treating a customer with chest pains and had to wait for a new ambulance to go to the hospital. And it was a bad week for King Edward VII Hospital in London, which gave out medical information about the pregnant Kate Middleton when Australian shock jocks made a prank call pretending to be Queen Elizabeth and Prince Charles. We thought we'd be hung up on as soon as they heard our terrible accents, said disc jockey Mel Gregg. Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the briefing section this week. The article is entitled, Throwing Money into the Ocean. As bills mount for Superstorm Sandy, there are growing doubts about the wisdom of national flood insurance. Why does the government sell flood insurance? When the National Flood Insurance Program was established in 1968, it was seen as a way to save taxpayers money. Instead of paying out massive emergency funds whenever a coastal area or river floodplain was inundated, the government figured it was more prudent to identify risky areas and force people who live there to buy insurance and assume some of the risk themselves. But the insurance industry wanted no part of the tricky business of calculating flood risk. It's like rat poison to them, says insurance industry lobbyist Tony Bullock. So the government had to underwrite the policies itself. By law, everyone who has a federally backed mortgage and lives within an area designated as prone to flooding once a century has to buy the insurance. There are currently 5.7 million flood insurance policies covering $1.27 trillion in property. But critics say the program, part of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, has backfired, creating huge debt for taxpayers, even as it rewards homeowners for trying to defy nature. Thanks to federal flood insurance, says Duke University coastal geologist Orrin Pilkey, we are subsidizing, even encouraging, very dangerous development. Why is flood insurance hurting taxpayers? It pays out far more than it takes in. The program currently collects $3.5 billion in annual premiums, a total that falls chronically short. The cost of damage from major hurricanes can be five or more times that, and as sea levels rise, weather becomes more extreme, and the value of flood-prone properties continues to soar. Nonetheless, massive payouts are becoming more frequent. Many policyholders, moreover, still pay subsidized premiums that reflect less than half of the true risk value. Even for vacation homes with prestigious addresses like Hilton Head, South Carolina, annual premiums are capped at $3,300. Flood claims from Hurricane Katrina alone totaled $21.9 billion, putting the U.S. flood insurance program $18 billion in the hole to the U.S. Treasury. And that was before it began processing claims from Hurricane Sandy. How does it pay for Sandy? Only by taking on more debt. Sandy is expected to generate up to $12 billion in claims, but only $2.9 billion remains on the flood insurance program's line of credit. That makes it almost inevitable that Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano will soon have to ask Congress to bail the program out again at a time when all federal expenditures are under intense scrutiny. When Congress voted in July to extend the program through 2017, it eliminated some subsidies and authorized premium hikes of 20% per year in high-risk areas and up to 25% per year for vacation properties. But many critics say those reforms are inadequate and that the government should get out of the flood insurance business altogether. What is their argument? Subsidized flood insurance, they say, is a classic example of moral hazard, encouraging people to take foolish risks by relieving them of the cost of bearing those risks. If we allowed market forces to dictate at the coast, a lot of the development in the wrong places would never have gotten built, said Jeffrey Tittle, head of the Sierra Club's New Jersey chapter. Texas Representative Ron Paul, a longtime critic of FEMA and no friend of the Sierra Club, agrees. The market would never provide insurance in flood-prone areas at an affordable price, he said. If it's a losing proposition, should taxpayers subsidize the inevitable losses? What are the alternatives? One would be to strategically retreat from flood-prone regions in a major way. Get appraisals for their homes, write them a check, knock the homes down, and just let it go back to its natural state, said Steve Sweeney, president of the New Jersey State Senate. Not surprisingly, Republican Governor Chris Christie has spurned that approach. I don't believe in a state like ours, where the Jersey Shore is such a part of life, that you just pick up and walk away, he said. Without insurance subsidies, he and others argue, lower and middle-class families simply could not afford to live on much of the Jersey Shore, and coasts and riverbanks elsewhere would become even more exclusive enclaves of the ultra-rich. Don't coastal residents get sick of rebuilding? They do, but they forget. After Hurricane Andrew devastated South Florida in 1992, property values, even in near-miss counties, dropped sharply, but with time, the sense of danger faded. Now far more people live in its path than did 20 years ago. If you look at it over the long term, people will still be attracted to the water, said Terrence Beattie, a real estate market researcher. That eternal attraction will continue to lead people to build close to the shoreline, with or without government insurance. I certainly love shoreside living, author and Long Island, New York coastal resident Carl Safina recently wrote. I love walking the beach in the morning with my dogs. I have federal flood insurance, thank you. But really, it's time you considered cutting me off. And now the footnote to this briefing column is entitled, The Payouts That Never Stop. Over the years, the federal government has shelled out a total of $2 million to repeatedly rebuild a flood-ravaged home in Humble, Texas, assessed at just $116,000. Another home in Wilkinson County, Mississippi, which is worth $69,900, has been flooded 34 times since 1978 and collected $663,000 in insurance payments. The National Flood Insurance Program has made efforts to stop paying out on such repetitive loss properties, which account for more than a third of its costs. But somehow they keep showing up on the books, especially in the Gulf of Mexico states from Texas to Florida. For David Conrad of the National Wildlife Federation, such outlays are the purest example of the folly of flood insurance. It does seem to fit Albert Einstein's definition of insanity to somehow expect something different when you do the same thing over and over again. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for the week, December 14th, 2012. Here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. We'll turn now to the best columns in the U.S., according to the Week magazine. The first one is The Costly Epidemic of Disability by Michael Barone in NationalReview.com. For many Americans, collecting disability has become a career, said Michael Barone. Over the past 50 years, the number of people receiving benefits from the Social Security Disability Program, created to help Americans who are too sick to work, has rocketed from 455,000 to 8.6 million. An incredible 5.6% of adults are now getting disability checks with a cost to taxpayers of $130 billion a year. The cause of this disability epidemic is simple. In recent years, the government has relaxed its disability standards and now readily accepts such unverifiable ailments as mood disorders, depression, and back, knee, and joint pain. Today, almost 50% of disability payments are going to people who claim pain or mental states that no doctor can observe or disprove. In other words, many people are gaming or defrauding the system. In 2010 and 11, 1,730,000 new jobs were created and 790,000 people went on disability. Many of these people will never rejoin the workforce and will never enjoy the satisfaction of earned success from honest work. Can our indebted nation continue to pay millions of adults not to work? The next column is entitled, Why I'm a Pro-Choice Republican, by Victoria Tonsing in the Washington Post. I am a pro-choice Republican, said Victoria Tonsing. There are millions of us, but since the party has become adamantly pro-life in recent years, most of us have been in the closet. I was raised to believe abortion is morally wrong and should be illegal, but a personal experience changed my mind. While pregnant with my third child, I asked my doctor if I could get a tubal ligation later. He informed me that Texas law restricted surgical sterilization based on a woman's age and number of children. As a conservative who believes in personal responsibility, this got me thinking that government had no business dictating my childbearing decisions. Today, however, pro-choice views are verboten in the Republican Party. So we end up running extremist candidates like Todd Akin, who confuse rape with sex, or hypocrites like Representative Scott Desjarlais of Tennessee, a pro-life doctor who, it's been revealed, had sex with multiple patients and twice helped his girlfriends get abortions. My fellow Republicans, there's nothing wrong with principled morality, but we should live it, not legislate it. And the next column from the Week magazine's Best of this week, Jefferson Deserves No Absolution, by Paul Finkelman in the New York Times. Thomas Jefferson is one of the most admired founders, said Paul Finkelman, but only because historians keep excusing his racism and cruelty. Nearly 200 years after the third president's death, the nation is still trying to reconcile the rhetoric of liberty in his writing with his lifetime support for slavery. In two recent Jefferson biographies, his slave owning is essentially excused as an artifact of his times. But the ugly truth is that the man who wrote the Declaration of Independence, which enshrines the self-evident truth that all men are created equal, was a disturbingly enthusiastic buyer and seller of human beings. George Washington and other leading contemporaries freed their slaves, recognizing the evil of owning men. Jefferson never did, keeping 175 slaves on his farm at Monticello and selling off slaves and breaking up families so he could buy wine, art, and other luxuries. He took his slave Sally Hemings as a mistress, yet to his dying days insisted that blacks were inferior to whites in body and mind, and lacked basic human emotion. So let's stop cloaking Jefferson in excuses. He was a creepy, brutal hypocrite. Now we'll flip to the back of the magazine for the week this week to the last word. The article this week is entitled, In Love with a Butt. And that is a robot, as you'll find out. When robots look like people or pets, says Robert Ito, it's hard not to develop feelings for them. The robot is smiling at me, his red, rubbery lips curved in a cheery grin. I'm seated in front of a panel with 10 numbered buttons, and the robot, a 3-foot-tall, legless automation with an impish face, is telling me which buttons to push and which hand to push them with. Touch 7 with your right hand. Touch 3 with your left. The idea is to go as fast as I can. When I make a mistake, he corrects me. When I speed up, he tells me how much better I'm doing. Despite the simplicity of our interactions, I'm starting to like the little guy. Maybe it's his round, silvery eyes and moon-shaped face. Maybe it's his soothing voice, not quite human, yet warm all the time. Even though I know he's just a jumble of wires and circuitry, I want to do better on these tests just to please him. The robot's name is Bandit. We're together in a tiny room at Rancho Los Amigos National Rehabilitation Center in Downey, California, where Bandit regularly puts stroke victims through their paces. They're very fond of him, says University of Southern California researcher Eric Wade, who has worked with Bandit and his predecessors for 5 years. The stroke victims chit-chat with Bandit, chide him, smile when he congratulates them. People will try to hug the robot, says Wade. We go out to nursing homes and people ask, when's the robot coming back? Bandit is one of a growing number of social robots designed to help humans in both hospitals and homes. There are robots that comfort lonely shut-ins, assist patients suffering from dementia, and help autistic kids learn how to interact with their human peers. They're popular and engineered to be so. If we didn't like them, we wouldn't want them listening to our problems or pestering us to take our meds. So it's no surprise that people become attached to these robots. What is surprising is just how attracted some have become. Researchers have documented people kissing their mechanized companions, confiding in them, giving them gifts, and being brokenhearted when the robot breaks or the study ends and it's time to say goodbye. And this is just the beginning. What happens as robots become ever more responsive, more human-like? Some researchers worry that people, especially groups like autistic kids or elderly shut-ins who are less apt to interact with others, may come to prefer their mechanical friends over their human ones. Are we really ready for this relationship? There are over 100 different models of social robots worldwide. The family includes machines that can act as nursemaids and housekeepers, provide companionship, talk patients through physical rehabilitation, and act as surrogate pets. The most popular, Sony's AIBO, A-I-B-O, Artificial Intelligence Bot, robot dog, sold more than 140,000 units before it was discontinued. The Japan Robot Association, an industry trade group, predicts that today's $5 billion a year market for social robots will top $50 billion a year by 2025. What makes these machines' popularity all the more remarkable is that they are a long way from the charming pseudo-humans of science fiction, your chatty C-3PO or cuddly Wall-E's. Many of these helpmates are little more than animatronic pillow pets. The Japanese-made Peiro, for instance, looks like a plush toy version of a baby harp seal. It coos, moves its head and tail, bats its long lashes, and that's about it. Even so, people adore it. More than 1,000 Peiros have been sold since its creation in 2003, making it one of the most popular therapeutic robots ever produced. In one study, a few people in two nursing homes seemed to believe that the Peiro was a real animal. Others spoke to it and were convinced that the Peiro, which can only squeak and purr, was speaking back to them. Or consider the Roomba, a robot vacuum cleaner that has sold more than 6 million units. In a 2007 study, researchers from Georgia Tech's College of Computing looked at the ways in which Roomba owners bonded with their gadgets. Though the machines have neither faces nor limbs and do little more than scuttle around and pick up lint, users were noted speaking to them, describing them as family members, even expressing grief when they needed to be hospitalized. "I love the silly thing," says Jill Cooper, co-founder of the frugal living website livingonadime.com. Cooper, like many Roomba owners, gave her robot a name, Bob, speaks to him, and shows him off to visitors. "I hate to get too deep here," she says, "but it's like trying to explain what it feels like to be in love to somebody who's never been in love before." "I've had to say goodbye to a lot of robots," laments Kirsten Williams, a senior robotics engineer at the research and development firm Applied Minds in Glendale, California. "If you have animals as pets, you go through the same process. You grieve and move on, and you try to re-engage with the next animal or the next set of robots. It's just that socially it's perfectly acceptable to grieve over a dog and maybe never get another one. If you're a roboticist, you can't do that." And it's not just social robots spawning teary farewells. When a U.S. Marines explosive technician in Iraq brought the blasted remains of Scooby-Doo, his bomb-disabling robot, to the repair shop, Ten Bogosh, the master sergeant in charge of the shop, told him the machine was beyond repair. Bogosh offered the Marine a new robot, but the mournful man insisted he didn't want a new robot. He wanted Scooby-Doo back. "Sometimes they get a little emotional," Bogosh told the Washington Post. In another instance reported by the Post, a U.S. Army colonel halted an experiment of the Yuma Proving Ground in Arizona in which a 5-foot-long insect-like robot was getting its many limbs blown off one at a time. The colonel, according to Mark Tilden, the robotics physicist at the site, deemed the spectacle inhumane. If veteran military officers can get choked up over a mechanized centipede, how hard might, say, a stroke patient fall for an artificial roommate? Imagine a household robot that looks like a person, says Matthew Schultz, a computer science professor at Tufts University. It's nice because it's programmed to be nice. You're going to be looking for friendship in that robot because the robot is just like a friend. That's what I find really problematic. Robots already are used extensively in Japan to help take care of older people, which concerns Sherry Turkle, director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. The elderly, at the end of their lives, deserve to work out the meaning of their lives with someone who understands what it means to be born, to have parents, to consider the question of children, to fear death, says Turkle. That someone has to be a person. That doesn't mean that robots can't help with household chores, but as companions, I think it's the wrong choice. Then again, assistive robots for the elderly are a hot topic precisely because, as populations age, there are fewer human caregivers to go around. Our work never aims to replace human care, says Maha Matarik, director of USC's Center for Robotics and Embedded Systems. There is a vast gap in human care for all ages and various special needs. The notion that people should do the caring is not realistic. There simply aren't enough people. We must find other ways to care for those in need. And the robots do seem to help. A 2009 review of 43 studies published in the journal Gerontology found that social robots increase positive mood and ease stress in the elderly. Some studies also reported decreases in loneliness and a strengthening of ties between the subjects and their family members. But Turkle wonders if such human-robot relationships are inherently deceptive because they encourage people to feel things for machines that can't feel anything. Robots are programmed to say, "I love you," when they can't love. Therapeutic robot pets like Abos and Paros feign pleasure when they don't feel. Are programmers deluding people with their lovable but unloving creations? People can't help falling for these robots, says Schultz. Soon, if we can avoid it, let's not design them with faces and humanoid forms. There's no reason that everything has to have two legs and look like a person. Unfeeling or not, a robot and its charms can be hard to resist. In the weeks following my meeting with Bandit, I find myself Googling his name and USC just to see if there's been any news about him. I don't think I miss him, really. I just want to know what he's been up to. Williams, the roboticist at Applied Minds, understands what I'm going through. As a graduate student at Caltech, Williams became attached to an ABO, one of many that she would take around to local schools to get kids interested in robotics. She took this particular ABO home, named him Rhodium. Her husband is a chemist. Played with him, learned his likes, a pink ball, and dislikes, having the antenna on his ear pushed the wrong way. But after graduation, she had to return Rhodium to the university. "I do wonder where he went," says Williams, "and I hope he still has his pink ball, because he'd be awfully sad if he couldn't find it. Sorry to say, the little robot dog undoubtedly misses his pink ball as much as he misses Williams, which is not at all." And that article was copyrighted 2012 by Pacific Standard Magazine and reprinted in the Week magazine with permission. Now we'll turn to the health and science section in the Week magazine for this week. Our first article here is entitled, "Troubling News About Tainted Pork." Pork sold in most supermarkets may be tainted with dangerous antibiotic-resistant bacteria. The nonprofit organization Consumer Reports tested nearly 200 supermarket pork samples and found that 69% harbored the bacterium Yersinia enterocolicata. Sorry if I got that wrong, but that is a tough one. Anyway, it causes food poisoning and is especially likely to infect children. Some 11% of the samples contained enterococci, a sign of fecal contamination, and between 3 and 7% hosted salmonella, staph, or listeria, all of which can cause serious illness. Researchers were particularly troubled that 90% of the bacteria found in pork were resistant to at least one antibiotic. Three of the samples had bacteria that were resistant to five antibiotics. Farmers routinely feed low levels of antibiotics to their livestock to make them plumper and keep them healthy, but this practice promotes the development of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which are a major public health concern, says study author Yuvashi Rangan. One in five pork samples also showed traces of ractopamine, a drug that farmers use to make hogs leaner, but that hasn't been approved for use in humans. Thoroughly cooking pork to at least 145 degrees will kill bacteria, but anything that touches raw meat could be contaminated and should be washed with hot, soapy water, Rangan says. Consumers can also buy organic pork at specialty stores such as Whole Foods or any pork that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has classified as free of antibiotics. The next article here in the Health and Science section, How Dogs Picture Words. When you say ball, your dog likely has a different category of objects in mind than you do. Researchers taught a border collie named Gable made-up words to denote certain objects, including a horseshoe-shaped toy they called a dax. When human babies learn to link a word like ball to a tennis ball, they're most likely thinking that ball means objects with a similar shape, like a basketball or a golf ball. But when researchers asked Gable to get another dax, he picked out an object of a similar size or texture to the original horseshoe toy, ignoring larger or smaller toys of the same shape. Dogs, it seems, don't share our shape bias, study author Emily van der Zee, a psychologist at the University of Lincoln in England, tells LifeScience.com. He thinks humans may have evolved to prioritize shapes when learning language because, for us, vision takes priority over the other sensory systems. Dogs handle objects with their mouths, so size and texture provide more relevant information. The youngest yawners. New 4D ultrasound scans have provided the first proof that fetuses yawn in the womb, a finding that adds to the mystery of why we yawn. Researchers imaged 15 fetuses four times, beginning at their 24th week of gestation. They found that the unborn babies yawned nearly twice every 10 minutes at first, but did so less frequently as time went on, until by their 36th week, they stopped yawning altogether. When you see a fetus yawning, it's not because it's tired, study author Nadia Reisland, a developmental psychologist at Durham University in England, tells the New York Times. Instead, yawning might be a way of getting the brain to develop. Yawning may also help fetuses build cartilage in their jaw. In adults, experts have theorized yawning may help cool the brain, since a lack of sleep raises brain temperature. That would be an explanation for why we yawn when we're tired. There's something special in yawning, Reisland says. Scientists just can't say for certain what it is. And the last article in the Health and Science section is the Health Scare of the Week. There's something every week, as you know. The Hidden Danger of Grapefruit. Combining grapefruit with prescription medication has become much more dangerous. A new study shows that over the past 4 years, the number of drugs that produce serious side effects, including gastrointestinal bleeding, kidney damage, breathing problems, irregular heartbeat, and sudden death, when taken even the night before eating the fruit or drinking its juice, has increased from 17 to 43. Those drugs include common prescriptions for blood pressure, cholesterol-lowering statins, pain and cancer medications, and some antibiotics. More than 40 additional drugs also interact with grapefruit with lesser side effects. Taking one tablet with a glass of grapefruit is just like taking five tablets with water. Study author of David Bailey, a pharmacologist at the Lawson Health Research Institute in Ontario, tells NPR.com. Researchers have known for 20 years that chemicals in grapefruit called furan-O-cucumerins block the ability of the small intestine and the liver to break down these drugs, causing them to stay in the body longer at higher levels and potentially leading to overdoses. Experts say even a little grapefruit juice can be dangerous. Now we'll look at the Talking Points section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article, Hillary, Why She'll Run in 2016. There can be no doubt about it, said David Remnick in NewYorker.com. Hillary Clinton is running for president. With the path to the 2016 Democratic nomination wide open, Clinton's approval numbers are through the roof, and she's already in high political gear. At a Washington conference on the Middle East this week, the soon-to-be ex-Secretary of State addressed an adoring crowd of dignitaries who swooned over a slickly produced video about Hillary's achievements. It all felt like an international endorsement 4 years in advance of the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary. She can partly thank the Republicans for her glowing reputation, said Steve Kornacki in the Salon.com. Republicans spent the past 4 years bashing Barack Obama as a liberal extremist and comparing him unfavorably with Hillary and Bill Clinton, whom they've been praising as torchbearers of a better, more moderate, and compromise-friendly Democratic Party. Don't crown Hillary yet, said Jem Garrity in NationalReview.com. She'll be 69 years old on Election Day 2016, and if elected, she'll be the second oldest president after Ronald Reagan. After 4 years of constant travel as the nation's top diplomat, she admits to being exhausted and does look a bit run down. All that hard work, meanwhile, has not produced a historical diplomatic success, akin to Henry Kissinger's opening of China, said Kenneth Walsh in USNews.com. Her record at state, from Benghazi through Afghanistan, will be closely scrutinized if she becomes a candidate. Still, Hillary has legions of admirers and a huge fundraising machine, so the question becomes whether she wants it or not. The next article, Baby Bust, the Declining U.S. Birth Rate. More babies, please, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. While politicians wrangle over tax rates and spending cuts in Washington, the greatest threat to our nation's long-term health may be what's happening or not happening in U.S. bedrooms. A new study by the Pew Research Center found that the U.S. birth rate in 2011 was the lowest ever recorded, with only 63 births per 1,000 women of childbearing age, down from 71 in 1990 and 122 at the height of the post-war baby boom. Obviously, the economic downturn has led many couples to have smaller families or postpone the next kid. But many are foregoing children because of a growing cultural decadence in which people live for their own pleasure while shrugging off the basic sacrifices that built our civilization in the first place. With the waning of religion in American life, said Jonathan Last in WeeklyStandard.com, we've fallen victim to the cult of the individual. Americans are so focused on their own personal fulfillment that they can't be bothered to raise a generation to replace them. Climate change, what the U.S. should do. The evidence for climate change has become too great to ignore, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. The polar ice caps are now melting three times faster than in the 1990s, and heat waves are withering crops from Kansas to Russia. A new study warned this week that runaway carbon emissions may leave the Earth a staggering 9 degrees Fahrenheit warmer by 2100, with consequences that are beyond bleak. A sea level rise of 3 feet, megastorms that ravage coastal cities, and droughts of biblical proportions. But all the president has offered so far to tackle climate change is a big lump of may, said Monica Bauerlein in MotherJones.com. As the UN begins climate change talks in Doha, Qatar this week, Obama needs to show that the U.S. will do its part to forge a global treaty to cut carbon emissions beginning in 2015. As Hurricane Sandy and this summer's record wildfires proved, we can't afford to keep paying the price of inaction. And now a few short items from the talking point section as we head up to the end of the program. Taxpayers reporting less than $50,000 in income provide 19% of money given to charity, but receive only 5% of the tax write-offs for donations, according to the Congressional Budget Office. About 70% of Americans do not have enough deductions to itemize on their returns, so the vast majority of charitable deductions go to the wealthy. The number of parents naming their daughters Apple jumped 15% in 2012 over the previous year, while the popularity of the name Mac for boys rose 12%. The number of people naming their baby daughters Siri, S-I-R-I, also rose 5% from last year. Households with incomes of under $13,000 a year spend an average of 9% of their income on lottery tickets. And the first text message was sent 20 years ago this week. It read, "Merry Christmas." Last year, more than 8 trillion texts were sent worldwide, or about 15 million per minute. Our poll watch, 40% of Americans describe themselves as very religious, attending church regularly and incorporating their faith into their daily lives. 29% are moderately religious, and 31% are non-religious. Religiousness is highest in southern states and among blacks and Mormons, and lowest among Jews. And 66% of adults use Facebook, and 16% use Twitter. Among people ages 18 to 29, 92% use Facebook and or Twitter, compared with 57% of those who are 50 to age 64. We've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to join me again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.